Regina Sarah Ryan has spoken here at Many Rivers Books and Tea many times before. It's been my deep pleasure every time. Every time I see Regina, our friendship deepens. My respect for her sagacity, her perspicacity. I don't think I can keep this going. Her wisdom deepen as well. And so tonight she's talking about something that's very close to my heart, which is some of the work of our mutual friend, Red Hawk, a poet who studied in the Fourth Way system very profoundly, and who has written some books about the basic practice that Stuart and I have been doing for lo these many decades after our teacher imparted it to us, and self-remembrance as well. Mm-hmm. So please join me once again in welcoming Regina Sarah Ryan to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Thank you, Rob. Please wave if my voice fades away so you get to hear me. Well, the title of the talk is The Destination is the Present. I like that because it's very, it actually moves you someplace. It's got a visceral quality to it. And it is a line that I find repeatedly in Red Hawk's second book on this subject called Self-Remembrance. He, at the end of almost every chapter, he keeps reiterating this point again and again, and he says, the destination is the present. It must be renewed with every breath, or the connection is lost. So wouldn't that be nice if tonight we could enter into the present here and there and be reminded of breath as the vehicle for bringing us into the present. The destination is the present. It must be renewed with every breath, or the connection is lost. A number of months ago, I was doing a program about working in the second half of life. And I was out here, and Betty came to my workshop, and it was wonderful to have you. And this whole idea that the destination was the present is very important for those of us who may have entered into that second half of life. As I look around the room, there's a few of us here who may have entered into that, even though we don't know, right? But the whole idea in the second half of life is that we have the opportunity for a different dimension of life rather than the linear dimension of life. We have the opportunity to plunge into a depth dimension, which is what characterizes the destination of the present. So I'm going to start tonight with reading some poetry, because for me, the poets say this in their own ways, in remarkable ways, and then I'll jump off of that and do my own thing. I don't exactly know how I'll do it, but we'll let the poets take us. And I'll start with my dear friend Red Hawk in his book Self-Observation. He is a professor of English literature and writing at University of Arkansas in Monticello, and he's a man in his mid-70s, early 70s, And he has been in this Gurdjieff work for 40 years, maybe. And but most of his writings have been as poetry. And he wrote this book, Self-Observation, and now the book called Self-Remembrance, as a distillation of a lifetime of practice. And he wrote it in such simple language that anybody can use it, even if you don't have any experience in that particular tradition. So here's a poem that he wrote in one of his other books, and he calls it The Development of Attention. We are caught by every vagrant breeze, our lives a constant distraction from what is right in front of us, our vision always on tomorrow, so that we miss the glory of today. But there are the few who understand that the doorway to the divine lies in the cultivation of present attention, a facility for seeing what is right in front of us. Louis Agassiz, the Harvard naturalist, was once asked what he had done with his summer vacation. I traveled far and wide, he said. How far? He was asked. I got halfway across my backyard, he replied. This is from the poet Rumi, who we all know. This is my little prayer book. You can see it's well worn. Everybody should have a prayer book, whether they believe in prayer or not, but you should have a book you carry around with you that reminds you of what's most important in your life, eh? I was riding on a subway in New York once, and I watched a little Hispanic woman take her prayer book out of her pocket and her rosary beads out of the other pocket and just make the whole trip with her prayer book and her rosary beads, and I thought, I'm going to get myself a prayer book. So this is it. Rumi is speaking here. Make everything in you an ear, each atom of your being, and you will hear at every moment what the source is whispering to you, just to you and for you, without any need for my words or anyone else's. You are, we all are, the beloved of the beloved, and in every moment of your life, the beloved is whispering to you exactly what you need to hear and know. Who can ever explain this miracle? It simply is. Listen, and you will discover it every passing moment. Listen, and your whole life will become a conversation in thought and act between you and the One, directly, wordlessly, now, and always. So part of my motivation in repeating this mantra, the destination is the present, is because I'm in my early 70s, and it's very, very important to have a good prayer to keep one reminded of what's necessary, really, and what it's about. because I don't operate as much as I used to under the illusion that I had this, these other moments coming that might be better than this one. No? And the second reason is very much tied into it for me. It's that my one of the primary threads in the tapestry of my life has been the thread of prayer and becoming a woman of prayer, becoming a person of prayer, so that the development of the inner life, that whether I was doing the dishes or whether I was sweeping the floor or whether I was sitting in front of a group like you, there was also an inner dimension in which I was connected to the ground well, the groundwater that you're all connected to. So at the surface of the well, is some of us have lots of agitation, and some of us have some, you know, frogs leaping around and fishes swimming and so on, but we go down further and further. The possibility exists that we come to a place of groundwater, a place that connects us universally. And so that, to me, is the journey of the inner life. And so for me, the destination of the present is the destination of that resting deeply in that place. Okay, I have one more poem that I want to read to you. It's one of my all-time favorite poems. William Stafford. And it's called A Ritual to Read to Each Other. I'll probably elaborate on this poem a little bit after I read it, because for me it's so relevant to our moment in this culture, in this country, in this particular challenge that we all face. A ritual to read to each other. If you don't know the kind of person I am, and I don't know the kind of person you are, a pattern that others made may prevail in the world. And following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. For there is many a small betrayal in the mind, a shrug that lets the fragile sequence break, sending out shouts, the horrible errors of childhood storming out to play through the broken dike. And as elephants parade, holding each other's tails, but if one wanders, the circus won't find the park. I call it cruel, and maybe the root of all cruelty, to know what occurs, but not recognize the fact. And so I appeal to a voice, to something shadowy, a remote region in all who talk. Though we could fool each other, we should consider, lest the parade of our mutual life get lost in the dark. For it is important that awake people be awake, or that breaking line may discourage all back to sleep. The signals we give, yes or no, or maybe, should be clear. The darkness around us is deep. This is about the exploration of the present moment to the point where one comes to know thyself, the living in the present moment, is only possible, and knowing thyself is only possible when one has a sense of oneself in the present moment, put it that way. And from the place of the present moment, then the pattern that others may prevail in the world will not lead us to the wrong God, who we will then follow home and thus miss our star. The absolute urgency of the know thyself, the absolute urgency of life arising in and out of the present moment of know thyself. And so the elephants, I love this image, the elephants are grasping each other's tails and following along. And one gets distracted. And what happens to the whole circus? They miss the park. I know nobody in this room gets distracted, you know. And the truth is, we do. We all do. You know, even in California, people get distracted. I always feel a little bit nervous coming to California because I'm only from Arizona, you know, and you guys are all like so spiritual and high and transcendent. No? Isn't that the case, Rob? Isn't it?
We're talking about the same California.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, I come from Arizona. No, I come from a town called Paulden, Arizona. We have a convenience store. It's known as the Pink Store, painted pink. But you don't ever want to go there. And we have a post office. That's what we have in Paulden. So I come here and it's like, oh my God. No, it's like, whoa, look at this. And there's so much going on. And there's an alternative around on every street corner. There's an alternative on every street corner. And it doesn't matter what how fancy the elephant is dressed, you know? I mean, everything that takes us away from this moment, from this present moment, awareness of our very own self, the observation of who we are, how we are, and what we are in each moment. You know, we're just fodder. We're just fodder for the mills of consumerism. We are. I shouldn't say that in a store like this. We really want you to buy things. Buy books. And especially buy my books. But, you know, it's the truth, right? I mean, we go into the stores and we're hypnotized. And we live in a culture that is hypnotized. We live surrounded by people who are hypnotized, and we are hypnotized too. And he's asking us, he's begging us, lest the parade of our mutual life gets lost in the dark. It is important that awake people be awake. And it's a presumptuous statement to say one is awake. You know, the people who are awake will not claim it. They will just say they're working at it. But it's so important to be working at that. Not working at it in a kind of way that causes, you know, your skin to fall off or you to become more stressed. We have a statement that people in my spiritual community love. It's like, practice like your hair is on fire. And I always go, oh no, please, really. To me, that brings on a panic attack. I want to practice like my heart is warming up enough to melt the icicles that easily form around it. I want to practice like my heart is warming to the place that it could possibly catch on fire. So it is important that awake people be awake, or a breaking line may discourage them back to sleep. When the elephants move, it's so easy to be moved with them. So let's make tonight the possibility that in this moment there will be moments of awakening. You will have awake moments here. Take a breath. If your posture is erect, if you have an actual connection to the fact that you're connected through the top of your head and the base of your spine and the soles of your feet, it's okay. There's a much greater possibility. Much greater possibility that you are, you know, present to what's present in the here and now. Step one, erect posture. Erect posture, and I'm doing a lot of, I've done a lot of work with women over many, many years, and I have to make a plug for my new book, which is just a segue into what I'm talking about. But my new book is for women. It's called Challenging the Lie of Never Good Enough. Challenging the Lie of Never Good Enough. And it's endemic to the culture, and it's a subtext of the lives of many women. I don't know what men do, but women do this a lot. To assume an erect posture and to be aware that one is assuming an erect posture, to take an erect posture consciously is a gesture, is more than a gesture, it is self-respect. Second possibility is to move from mentalization into sensation. And the way in which Red Hawk describes it in his work, he says, place conscious attention at an area of the body, of the abdomen, the solar plexus, the heart, the gut, the dantian, conscious placement of attention in the body. So as I'm speaking it now, just go there. Have erect posture and then put conscious attention at some area of this abdominal center so that you're moving into the physical. It's not about getting dreamy. You don't have to close your eyes to do this. It's to come present. And the third phase of this awaken, sense your breath. Not watch your breath, not observe your breath, not count your breath. Sense. Like, be inside of it so you're actually sensing the breath. Sense the breath. Sense the whole body now. Step four, sense the whole body. Step five, relax the body. Relax. This is called, in Red Hawk's terminology, and he has his own unique ways of saying things, this is called first stage self-observation, self-remembrance. It's a valiant effort. It's a great effort. And the effort of moving the attention constantly from mentalization into sensation is a practice that builds a body, builds an inner body. So that you're walking through life not only being following the next elephant in front of you. You're aware where you're standing, how your own body is, how your own breath is moving, how your posture is, whether or not your mind is leading everything or you're actually in tune with the physical body, and you're relaxed, which doesn't mean you're flopsy-mopsy. You know, you have erect posture, but you're also relaxed, and you have a sense of yourself as the whole body. It's remarkable. It's remarkable. And the second stage, I'm giving you a lifetime in a lifetime course here. And the second stage is that you have all of that, but also you have an inner attention on all of that, and you have an outward attention on what's all around you. So you have what's known as split attention. Inner sense and outer sense. Because why would you want to only have the inner sense? You know, you'd be isolated from the rest of us. You wouldn't be in relationship to me. But if you're practicing self-observation, if you're within, you know, your own sense of who you are, and you're in relationship to me, then spontaneously what can arise between us, we have no idea. It's the present. We don't have a plan, do we? What's your name?
Chance.
Oh yeah, Chance, of course. I thought I knew who you were. Nice to see you again. Wonderful name. Yeah. So we have a possibility of a relationship that's brand new. For that moment, yeah. Yeah, for that moment. Are we on track? Yeah?
Yeah, another phrase that I liked from my dog was, he said, it's going home.
Yeah.
Going home. Centering prayers does the same thing.
Yeah.
But that whole idea of going home, come home, stay home, stay in place.
Yeah.
And there are expressions I really like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all the rest of it, he says, none of your business. He said, what about this? It's none of your business.
Yeah.
What do you mean it's none of my business? You know, he's like, go home and see what happens from that place. Otherwise, you're going to screw it up any hour, I guess. But I like that. I love that.
Yeah.
Stay centered. Best you can.
This is my husband, Jerry, by the way. He's a dear friend of mine. And 40, going on 44 years of marriage together, so we have a little experience together. In the community that I'm a part of in Arizona, our spiritual teacher, Lee Lazarev, died in 2010, and so we're coming up on the 6th anniversary of his passing. And so there's lots of change going on. Things are changing. People are changing. Some people are getting closer in, some people are getting further out. You know, there's lots of things. Oh, we have to define our vision, and we have to do this, and we have to make a board of directors, and we have to, all these different things going on. And, you know, that's what happens. I mean, change is inevitable. And for me, if all of us are practicing at this level that I'm speaking of tonight, if we're all working at this level of the destination is the present, self-observation, the domain of sensation, the ability to stay in a mode of relaxation, what will need to change within our Sangha body becomes more and more obvious. We're able to see what's wanted and needed. We do have planning sessions. We have wonderful planning sessions. And the more the individuals in those planning sessions have this option of coming from this place that I'm talking about being in the present of the destination, the more the possibility is that what's going to flower out of that is right, is what is wanted and needed in that moment. So it's not a question of never making a plan, but it's making a plan from the place of the context of this destination is the present, the breath is the vehicle, and self-observation is the key. So it's, I'll tell you that for myself, this whole possibility of learning through sensation is really a new thing. You know, I've always loved to dance, and after I left the convent, after having been a nun for many years, I started doing yoga, and I learned that my physical body was really cool. I could pray with the body. But the idea that the body was giving me constant information, like an information source. I know you all know this because you're from California. But if you're from Arizona, you don't always know this, that sensation is an amazing tool of self-knowledge. And that there is a dimension of sensation that is going on all the time that I don't even know how to read and fully interpret, because it's like a whole new language that I haven't learned. I didn't learn the language of sensation. Sensation in the sense of feeling the energetic of what's arising in the moment, sensing whether something was, you know, left or right, experiencing the contraction or the expansion in different parts of my body when a conversation was going on. Because there was so much, I'm smart mentally. I can, you know, I've read a lot, and I'm an book editor, so I know how to parse your sentence. But there's a way in which these qualities of mental sharpness actually keep one always listening from the perspective of what's next, what's wrong, what's right, what do I agree with, where can we go with this, how is it going to happen next, what's the segue, Jim's talking about this, oh, I read an article in New Yorker about that, okay, and then he says this, okay, and I remember this happened. You all do that, right?
No.
No, they don't do
it
here?
We're from California.
Oh, that's right. You don't do it here. And there's something wonderful about that. There's a joy in a type of repartee that happens over the dinner table where everybody's talking and you can hardly get a word in edgewise. I mean, I love that. I love that. But when someone comes to you and they're like in need, or they're in, you know, involved in something that's really a deep question for them, to have that not be the way in which one is listening, but to rather be in observation of oneself, to be in tune to the breath, and then to not know what one might say next. The children do this to me. They go, tell us a story. Okay, once upon a time there were 12 dancing princesses. No, not that kind of story. We want you to make up a story. Where do you start with that? Well, some people are very good at it, but some aren't. But to just have nothing, to like have no idea where you're going to go, and to just start about, there was this magical bookstore and nobody knew where the magic books were, but if you happened to take one off the shelf, a door opened up. Now, I mean, you know, so you go on. Here we go. So the mind is wonderful, you know, the imagination is wonderful. And when Jerry used the phrase minding one's own business, minding my own business, how much of the day do I spend in unnecessary thinking? Unnecessary thinking. Blah, 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 blah. And then he might say, and then I'd have to say, and then when we get there, we'll have to do this. And what if when I get there, the wheelchair's not ready for Jerry, and then I have to call the thing, and then we don't know, do I have my ticket, and is Rob not here? You know those kind of things? Yeah, we all do. So we use we use this practice, the simple practice of self-observation, of noting the posture, of moving the center of attention into the physical body, of sensing the breath, of sensing the whole body. And this doesn't have to go on, you know, this is not like a 15-minute process. It happens very quickly as one practices it. Sensing the whole body and then relaxing the whole body. When one becomes aware of unnecessary thinking, which is a lot. Just a really a lot. Not bad. Just like, what do you want to do with your one wild and precious life, like Mary Oliver says, you know? What do you want to do with your one wild and precious life? Is this how you want to, is this how you want to spend your time? You could be spending your time, you know, celebrating divine beauty, you know? Speaking the name of God. You could be spending the time singing, you know, the praises of a flower. You could be spending your time observing what's right in right at your feet. You know those Sufis, they're the best at this stuff. They have this cool stuff. You know the Naqshbandi Sufis? Some of you know Naqshbandi Sufis. Llewellyn Vaughan Lee is in this area, and he's a sheikh in this particular tradition, and they have these various points, principles that guide their practice. And they have 11 basic principles. I'm not going to go through all of them for you, but principle number two, I'll start with number two. Principle number two is watch your step. Direct yourself constantly towards the goal. Watch your step can refer to watching circumstances, feeling when is the right time for action, when is the right time for inaction, when is the right time for pause. This refers to the wisdom inherent in one's natural disposition. So it's like a sense of listening. Watching your step is listening to your own natural wisdom moving right or left. It's one of the principles of this particular work. Watch your step. Lots of us have back problems, and we know that a lot of it is because we're not watching our step properly. We're not walking properly. You got pelvis stuck out one way, and you know, lumbar going this way, and heel going that way, and toe going that way. You know, it's without watch your step, that kind of alignment. The first one is awareness in the breath. First principle in this particular tradition. Every breath which is exhaled from within must be exhaled with awareness and presence of mind, and so that the mind does not stray into forgetfulness. The soul has long been thought to be in the breath. Awareness of the breath makes us aware of the soul and the inner body, the inner self, all of which belong to the present moment. there's no inner life in the past. There's no inner life in the future. You know, one's inner life is a present phenomenon only. I love these guys. They have such cool things. And I'll read you one more. But you're going to have to search it out if you want to find out the other ones. Number 9 of 11 is called awareness of one's state of mind. If you don't know the kind of person I am, I don't know the kind of person you are, then a plan that somebody else conceived is going to take us down the road, and following the wrong God home, we may miss our star. Okay? Well, the Sufis said it long before that. They said, awareness of one's state of mind. To be attentive to one's state of mind at any given moment, and to know whether it is a cause for giving thanks or for repenting. And I don't think we have to take the whole idea of repenting as like some big thing, you know, committing sin. But rather, is it a cause for celebrating? Is it a cause for giving thanks? Where is my mind right now? Where is my mind right now? This is very hard in an election year. Yeah? It is. It's very, very hard in an election year to be attentive to where the mind is. Where is the mind? I was walking, you know, I live in Paulden, Arizona. I was walking through the Safeway in Chino Valley, which is the next, Chino Valley, Arizona, which is the next town. And we have a huge supporter, we have huge supporters of some very conservative Arizona principles, if you know what I mean. And I'm walking through the store and I'm looking at people and I'm thinking, I bet they would vote for so-and-so. I bet they would advocate the so-and-so. And all of a sudden I'm like, Regina, where is your mind? Mm-hmm. Where is my mind right now? You know, like, there's this woman and she's just like looking at the chicken. You know, what have I done to her? And where is my mind gone? Okay, it's not like, I don't repent in the sense that I'm a bad person, but it's like it wakes me up. It wakes me up. And so then the possibility becomes for me, I could bless her. I could, you know, bless her. Oh God, please let her make the right decision in the election. No, I don't bless her that way. You know, I bless her. Isn't that funny how the mind works though? You know, I'm going to pray for those people so that they come around to my way of thinking. Or whatever. I don't know what your minds do. I'm just talking from inside mine. Yes, your name?
I'm Corinne.
Corinne, yeah.
And at this Gangaji workshop, somebody shared about somebody they had a resentment about, and they had this insight, and she ended up saying, may he have a better life than I do. Mm. And that was like the ultimate turning around of all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I thought that was... I remember that. I can't always do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
we can't do it, but we could intend. We could
turn there.
We could orient ourselves in that direction. The possibility exists that one could make that as an intention, possibility. Yeah. Yes, Chan.
And if it's a practice, you keep noticing and noticing. You get better and better at noticing, and better and better at just blessing.
Yes.
Practically indiscriminately,
yes.
But especially loud noises and rude behavior and barking dogs,
yeah.
Politicians and so forth.
Yeah.
The more it's practiced, calmer the breath becomes.
Yes.
And the easier, the more frequently we're in that state,
yes.
As opposed to having to wake up, we're already blessing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a whole way in which the old habits are changing.
I like that line in Martin Stafford's poem about, and maybe you could read it again, about the all the small betrayals that happen in our mind.
Oh yeah.
And I mean, that really hit me as true that when our mind is just busy, we betray sometimes our spiritual impulse or our open heartedness.
Yes, it's true. The interesting thing, and Chance was bringing it up about the fact as well, is that when you commit to a practice, you commit knowing that it is going to show you more and more and more. That's why these types of practices are not for the weak of heart. Because if you undertake this, it's not about bliss and angels singing. It's about showing you day after day, day in and day out, how I am, you know, betraying these women, these hardworking women in Safeway who are buying the chicken thighs, you know? And I, say you really want to deeply practice the 37 practices of the Bodhisattva. You know what this means? You know the Bodhisattva is the one who keeps coming back lifetime after lifetime. So they say there's these essential 37 practices that Shantideva wrote about. And one of them is like, it has to do with very quickly, you know, forgiving and like not holding anything past a moment, you know. So Jerry and I had a disagreement.
When was that?
Remember that back in 1976, I think. And so you're practicing the Bodhisattva in order that all beings may have a better life than you, or you may relieve the suffering of all sentient beings. And we have an argument, and I can tell that I've hurt him. I got him this time. You know, I don't have that much luck getting him, but sometimes I do. So this particular time I got him, and I could tell he was suffering from what I had said. I mean, I'm laughing about it now. It's not so funny. Right, hon? Remember that time? So, and I'm there, and I'm in the moment, in that moment, I'm saying, he's suffering. Great. Maybe now he'll get that he has made me suffer in the past. And I'm getting, oh, well, you're not married to me, Chance. You'll keep your luck. I mean, it's so quick. I won the argument, and in that instant, he gets to suffer. And I rejoice in that one instant that I won. And then my immediate choice, my immediate next immediate question is, how long do you want to prolong this? For how much longer do you want him to suffer? Or can you turn immediately and like go there and get down on your knees, you know? I mean, he's in a wheelchair, that's why I have to get down on my knees, but you know what I mean. It's like, go right there and just say, you know, sorry, you know, really, please, you know? Or however one does it. Could we replay that, please, you know? And then just walk the path backwards, rewind tape on this and work it. But that type of sensitivity to that situation comes because one has made a commitment to relieve the suffering of sentient beings. And in that comes the stuff comes up. Red Hawk says it very well. You read this. Are you sitting with a question or a comment?
Oh, eternally.
Eternally? With your hand up? Go. Yeah.
The conceptual brain, unless it is mind will take over. And you will, and we will, I have used the conceptual brain to control the conceptual brain, not knowing that I was actually deepening its control.
Yeah.
So I was totally lost until I learned the sign for pause.
The sign for?
Pause.
Pause.
And learned to shut it down.
Yeah.
Just to shut it down. And to understand that it does not want to control, that it gets trapped in this position.
Yeah.
Simply because we don't know how to turn it off.
Yeah.
So teaching children work, teaching, as soon as we start learning words, we enter into conceptual space.
Yeah.
And if we're not shown how to leave it, that's it.
Yeah.
And so it's essential, it's vital that when the child can kind of choreograph or manage the voices that are coming at it from every direction.
Yeah.
And can turn them off and invite them. So, so since I started inviting my hands into the conversation, suddenly, I would say a living dimension has entered into my inner dialogue, my conversation with myself. And before, it was not there because...
Yeah. Thank you. This is to reinforce the point about how when we put our attention on something, it can become more and more difficult to observe this, to deal with what arises. Know thyself, Socrates exhorted his disciples to do so. Every master, including Jesus, who called it witnessing, has taught his disciples to observe themselves, so they might come to know themselves. On the other hand, I am no master, and I say, don't do it for God's sake, because they never tell you the trouble it brings, how we will never sleep easily again in our unconscious, selfish, mad habits, how what is now unconscious, hidden in us, will be revealed, like opening a locked cellar door, turning on the light, and what you find down there is a county asylum crawling with inmates, some wrapped in torn, filthy sheets, others naked and drooling. They are clawing and scratching to gain position on the stairs to escape, and standing calmly in their midst, dressed in robes of light, is an angel around whom most of them huddle weeping, whose gentle touch upon their fevered brows calms and soothes them. This is what I'm warning you about. Never mind the swarming lunatics, they are everywhere. But once you have seen that angel in your midst, the sorrow and the longing will tear at you and trouble you all the days of your life. Yeah, it takes great courage to even set our foot on the path of this type of work. If we don't see that kind of drooling inmates in ourselves, we begin to see it more and more and more in the heartbreak that we see around us. And it's important that awake people be awake, but awake people doesn't mean blissful people tiptoeing through the tulips and, you know, just scattering rose petals. It means having the heart broken. So unnecessary thinking is when we apply this type of technology. The second time we apply this technology is with any kind of excessive emotion. You know, we call it, you know, high drama. High drama of any kind. Some people don't have any relationship to high drama, but some people I know very well have a big relationship to high drama. And when one observes themselves in the clutches of strong emotion, one can apply this technology. The beauty of this particular technology is not to calm yourself. It's not about calming yourself from anger or calming yourself from freak out. It's about getting to know yourself in the midst of that, and really getting to know yourself and taking the energetic that's been aroused and internally eating it, like eating it as a type of food that then gets recirculated in the system that gets transformed. So somebody encounters some kind of a difficult situation, you know, we're standing, you know, impatience is starting to arise. And it's not like I'm going to breathe in order to calm the patients. It's that I'm going to recognize that the impatience is arising. And I'm going to go into the body with it and feel where, you know, what impatience is doing in the body in this moment. And in that, I'm going to sense the whole body. And I'm going to relax the whole body. I'm not trying to stop the impatience. I'm just observing what it does. Now, the interesting thing about all of this is that the body knows what to do with that. The mind doesn't know what to do with that. Mentalization knows how to enhance that and start getting agitated and start making phone calls about it. No, it knows how to use its iPhone. But the body knows a different type of inner technology. So either, as Red Hawk will put it, either you get eaten by this bear or you eat the bear. So the bear is what's arising, and you are actually taking all the energetic. It's not like you're not trying to make it go away. You're simply observing how it's arising, where it's moving, and then you're staying present to it. And as you watch it change, just like you do when you practice meditation. You watch the arising, you watch the sustaining of the thing, and you watch the subsiding of the thing. So you do this with unnecessary thinking, you do it with excessive emotion, you do it with any kind of recognition of habit. When you notice yourself in a state of any kind of habit. I have this thing I call the Regina Ryan Show, which is noticing myself on automatic. Do you ever notice yourself on automatic? My particular brand of automatic is, you know, it's very unique to me. It's something I slip into because my default, one of my defaults is that I need you to like me. So I just go into this, you know, thing where my face takes on a certain expression, my body posture does a certain thing, the speed of my voice increases, the amount I talk increases because I mustn't let another word, you know, invade this space here. And the next thing I know, I do not even know who I am. It's just this mechanism going on. I'm seeing the machine in operation over and over and over and over. Well, we know we can do lots of things mechanically. We drive our cars easily all the time, and we don't even, you know, how did I get here? we're on automatic a lot of the time. But the fact that I'm on automatic in my relationships with the children, in my job, in, you know, certain things, going from one place to the other. I mean, why do you think they say over and over, you know, stop and smell the roses along the way? And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to catch oneself on automatic. I mean, I don't think there's really any way to work with this unless we can begin to see that that's what's happening. Because when I'm on automatic, I am not present. My destination is not the present. I'm like someplace in this, I don't know, child adolescent stage where I'm trying to survive in some way, or I'm in some future place of trying to accomplish or manipulate or you know, have something happen that way. But this sense of, you know, this sense of like being on show rather than being here. And the fourth time the fourth thing that you recognize is tension in the body. All these four are fabulous clues that tune you into the fact that you've left the present moment and that you've gone someplace else, and therefore you can then come back. It's all done very gently and without judgment. So the tension in the body is an indication of something, you know. Where, you know, what's happening now? What's going on here? Why is this happening? Or not even having to ask that question why, but just noticing that the body is tense and then bringing in that possibility of this simple self-observation. There's tension in the physical body. There's tension in the belly. I don't even have to consciously tell myself to relax the tension in the body, because as soon as I bring my attention there, what happens? With the awareness comes the movement. Well, that's way more than I could possibly expect myself to be a stand for in every moment. So, you know, I'm in practice with this. And one of the reasons that I gave this as the topic of the talk tonight is that it's so important to me, because I think it is such a simple technology for the relief of suffering. Grady.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I get really angry. I don't give a crap about observing anything. Like, how do you... like, I don't want to. I want to identify. I want to throw things. What do you do then? Just wait it out. I mean, it passes, I guess.
Well, do you know that you're angry?
Yeah.
And you know and you're saying to yourself, I don't care. I don't care to observe myself. I want to stay identified.
Yeah, I'm like, it's really embarrassing. Like I've made a donation to Trump. It's like I want to destroy the world. So, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't want to practice. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Like, I can know about all kinds of things that would help. Could give me, like. I mean, like, it's awesome to feel my, like, I've been really enjoying feeling my breath tonight.
Yeah.
But it's weird because it's a survival mode, and it's like I don't want to live, you know?
Yeah.
It's like I'm just going to survive till death.
Yeah. So the question is that you can answer you for yourself because you already are. I mean, the necessary component of this is it's done with gentleness. The observation is always done without judgment. You turn over the rock and you see the scorpion, but you don't smash it. So what the practice is doing is turning over the rock, and then you're observing. You know, you might step out of the way, but you're not going to kill it because it's going to show you something. I don't know how to. I'm not interested in fixing it for you or whatever, but to observe. And then the desire to the desire to work will come in. It comes in different moments, right? I mean, you do have moments, right?
Oh yeah.
You have awake moments too. So. Work while the sun shines. I'm going to look at my notes here, but if anybody else has any questions before we go, I'd love to hear them. Yes, Celine.
I'm Corinne. Can you tell me the name of your teacher again?
Lee Lozowick.
What's the last name?
Lozowick. Lee is a. He's deceased as of 2010, but he was he's an American who I met in 1984. And the tradition that he shared with his students is known as the Western Bowl tradition. And the Bowls of Bengal are an itinerant sect of musicians, beggars, and mad lovers of God. And so he did his own particular riff on that in the West. They also draw from many different traditions, the traditions of Buddhism and Hinduism and Sufism, so on. And so we had a very eclectic introduction to many of those things. So some of us came into our work with him having little or no spiritual background. Others, like myself, had come in from a very traditional spiritual background. And, you know, I came in as a good Catholic, ex-Catholic nun, and I ended up in the, you know, in the Ratskellers in Berlin listening to rock and roll, because he took us on tours of Europe, you know, playing rock music. So it was a fantastic spiritual gift in my life to be able to be exposed to a type of practice that incorporated all aspects of life, you know, art and music and prayer and raising of children and human relationship and all of that. So, it's a good deal. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for asking. Oh, here's a lovely poem. You know David White? You know that wonderful poet David White? Oh, here's a nice poem by him. Enough. These few words are enough. If not these words, this breath. If not this breath, this sitting here, this opening to the life we have refused again and again until now. Until now. That's all.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I want to point out that we haven't emphasized this terribly, but in addition to being freelance editor, retreat leader, etc., that Regina is also the author of a number of books. This is my personal favorite, Praying Dangerously, but Igniting the Inner Life is here as well, The Woman Awake, and we have two used copies, which is a
oh, that's
get a
nice.
Deal.
You can get cheap it. Cheaper.
And then we have some other books here as well, relevant to what we've been talking about tonight. Self-Observation by Red Hawk, an excellent, excellent book, as well as Self-Remembering. So check them out on your way. That was really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Is there a bowl on the front?
There is a bowl on the front, and the last thing to mention, Stuart has already mentioned, which is that we have a donation bowl here. We encourage you to contribute to it so that we can share half with our speaker, retain half to maintain these events in the future of the store. And thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.